Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Imagine this. Later today, you'll be going about your business and then suddenly the police are there. They arrest you and they charge you with a serious crime. It could be rape or assault or murder. And it's a crime that you know absolutely nothing about. Your case goes to trial. And even though you insist you've got nothing to do with that crime, there's something about the evidence presented against you that's just so compelling, the jury votes to convict. You go to prison, and more than that, you wear the weight of this despicable crime around you. And then there's also the fact that you know that the real perpetrator is possibly still at large. Professor Paul Wilson returns to Conversations today with some hair-raising stories to tell of wrongful convictions and miscarriages of justice. Paul Wilson is a well-known Australian criminologist and forensic psychologist, and he believes that his form of psychology can help to prevent these things from ever happening. Paul, welcome back to Conversations.
Thank you, Richard.
This can happen to forensic psychologists. This is amazing. Tell me the story of Donald Thompson and how he was arrested.
Well, Donald Thompson is a very famous, and rightly so, forensic psychologist and barrister who very early on in his career in 1975 was giving a lecture, or was on a panel discussion, actually, on television with the Assistant Commissioner of Police, talking about the unreliability of eyewitness testimony. And at the same time he was talking, a woman was raped in a home by an intruder. And then what happened was Thompson, after the program, found himself arrested. And
where was he arrested? How was he arrested?
He was arrested a day later and accused of, I think he was arrested actually in his home, but he was accused of being the rapist. Now, Donald hardly fits the profile of a rapist, I know him, and he was amazed. What they found out was that the woman who had been raped had seen him on television, and his image had been transfixed into her memory, and she thought that he was the rapist. Well, he wasn't. He had a great alibi. He was on a television program at the time of the rape with the Assistant Commissioner of Police, and the real culprit was eventually caught.
Now, the victim actually identified him in a police lineup, didn't she?
Yes, yes.
Named him, spotted him in a police lineup, and so the police took this very, very seriously. So
absolutely. I mean, the police had every right to, I think, given what the woman had said. But what we do know now, and what, in fact, Thompson has had been talking about on television and has since, is that witnesses, eyewitnesses, can be very unreliable. What we think we see is not actually what we do see.
The spectacular weirdness of that. The fact that he'd been on television talking about the unreliability of eyewitness testimony is the moment when this woman, through a moment of deep and dreadful trauma, confused the identity of her attacker.
Yeah, I think this is really the issue, that if you are the victim of a crime, it's a highly traumatic occasion, and often your memories get distorted. And the other thing, I think, is that the more confident you are that you actually do remember the details of the perpetrator in a crime, often the wronger you are, the more errors you make. So, you know, confidence is not actually related to a accurate ability to recall.
One of my colleagues at ABC Radio, Madonna King, was telling me about how she discovered an intruder in her house, and her husband had seen this intruder as well. When the police arrived, she gave a detailed description of the man who'd pushed past her to get out of her house. And she said, in every instance, her description of him was wrong, except for the white thongs he was wearing. In every single instance, her description of this man, she discovered later, was wrong. She eventually wrote a column about this and found this. Her husband identified him pretty well, but she gave it wrong. And it really shocked her and it made her really think about what happens when we give eyewitness testimony to what we'd seen.
Yeah, we have an experiment we give in our miscarriage of justice course that we run every year, and we have somebody who rushes into the room and steals the lecturer, whether it be me or my colleague, Eric Collins.
No warning.
He just rushes in and steals something from the bench. This is a classic psychology experiment, and steals a wallet or a bag. And then we ask the students to actually recount how tall he was, how big he was, how much he weighed, what he wore, what he said, did he have a weapon. And we find the majority of the students get at least some of the details very wrong indeed. And that convinces them, I think, that eyewitness testimony can be inaccurate. It's a very standard psychology sort of an experiment to do.
It's easy to get details wrong. He was wearing a blue shirt or a red shirt or something like that.
Yeah.
Do you find in the process your students will invent whole aspects of the incidents?
Oh, absolutely. Another experiment we do is to show an actual police hostage situation where an armed robber, for example, is holding a victim of some sort, and the police are surrounding them, and then shots are fired. And we find that when we ask the students to recount what they've seen on a television clip of this, that they often get, they're often two people who are the robbers or the hostage takers rather than one. We get the who fires the first weapon wrong. All sorts of things go wrong in terms of their descriptions. And that's very common.
Years and years ago, I was mugged at knife point in Sydney. I was sitting at a cafe. I'd seen the guy walk down past me. Then a few minutes later, he appeared, jabbed something in the small of my back. He was standing behind me, and I thought he was faking. It felt like he was digging his thumbnail into
right,
just under my
right
stare.
Yeah.
And demanded my wallet, and I handed it over, and he took off. The police came straight away after I'd rung them. And in the process of making a statement where you have to recall every single moment of that incident is really quite weird, because the moment itself is so compressed that when you try to recall something broken down moment by moment, it's very interesting. And all sorts of new things happen. And eventually the police said, "Did he have a bag?" And I went, "Yes." And I'd actually been staring at this guy's bag the whole time he'd held me up.
Did you get the colour right of the bag?
Yes, I did.
You did?
I did
okay.
get the colour right. But I neglected to mention it because I completely hadn't remembered it at all. And then I did once it was put to me that there might have been a bag there. They didn't sort of lead the question. They didn't say, was there a blue bag? But it was indeed a blue bag. And then I did get the colour right. And a day later, he was picked up. The blue bag was there. My wallet was inside of it, and a very long Bowie knife as well.
Right,
He didn't hurt me in any way. And the experience wasn't traumatic, but it was weird. It was weird.
Yes, yes.
So it's no wonder that memories go a bit odd under the circumstances.
Well, I think the thing really is that you actually feel emotionally as though this is what you have remembered. And the more you think about it, often the wrong memory gets consolidated in your mind.
In the case of this woman who'd seen the forensic psychologist on TV while she was being sexually assaulted, what's the process by which those memories can become confused? Cryptomnesia is what it's called sometimes, isn't it? Tell me about the psychological process that's going on when these things are getting confused.
Well, you see something. It can be in dim light, as it has been in many rape situations where the victim feels as though she can remember who the perpetrator was, and there have been many cases besides Don Thompson like that. It's dim light. You think about it after the event. Often that gets distorted with the interview you carry on with a police officer or a social worker. That memory gets often confused with other memories of traumatic situations. And then eventually you come to a sort of a feeling, a memory yourself, which becomes consolidated, and you're sure that's right when in fact it's wrong. So there are a whole lot of ways in which the initial reaction to the traumatic event can become distorted and you believe that it's actually happened, and you're very confident that you've actually seen the perpetrator. You can describe that person when you can't, when you have it completely wrong.
So it's not dishonesty?
No, it's not dishonesty. I mean, in the case of this woman who, in the Don Thompson example, she actually really believed that this was Don Thompson. In the case of other cases I'm aware of rape cases, for example, the victims actually do believe that the person they've described to the police is the actual person when they're not.
So there's something about the nature of that trauma then. It tends to shatter the mind and shatter the recollection of the moments.
It's a whole lot of very complex situations. It's the state of mind of the victim. It's the actual physical light in which it's seen. It's the characteristic of the perpetrator of the crime. If it's a black person, for example, who's the alleged alleged offender, often that's not recounted as well in terms of the details as if the person was a white perpetrator. There are so many variables which can distort the final image.
It seems to be over the last 10, 20 years or so, now that DNA evidence is able to overturn many cases of wrongful conviction, greater and greater doubt is now being placed on the role of eyewitness testimony in court cases?
Well, yes and no. In Australia, judges often warn juries about the unreliability of eyewitness testimony. But in Australia, generally speaking, it's very, very difficult to have an expert, a forensic psychologist, for example, to talk A, generally about how unreliable eyewitness testimony is, and B, to talk specifically about the case, the fact that in this particular case, because of bad light conditions or because of how the victim and the perpetrator interacted, there is likely to be an unreliable memory of what actually happened. Because courts in Australia generally believe that you don't need expert evidence in eyewitness situations. Juries are capable, as common people, to make up their own mind. But, you know, eyewitness testimony, as you yourself have found out, is something which is very complex, where things go wrong very easily.
Do you think forensic psychologists such as yourself should provide advice to the court during court proceedings on the reliability of testimony they've just heard, or before they're about to hear it?
Well, I think both. I mean, I think it's very important to for forensic psychologists to tell lawyers defending people where the only evidence might be eyewitness testimony about where things can go wrong and how they've gone wrong in particular cases. But I also believe that courts should allow eyewitness testimony in a lot of cases where such testimony is really the compelling evidence against somebody accused of a crime.
But there's problems there too, because one thing we know about psychologists, and again I found us on the show, yeah, they get things horribly wrong and often.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm saying in a talk I'm giving at a national conference in a couple of days, actually, that forensic psychologists often overestimate their own abilities, and often we use tests and assessment methods without saying some of the weaknesses of those particular psychological tests. And while I think forensic psychologists should give evidence in court about eyewitness testimony and recovered memories and false confessions and a whole lot of areas, I believe they must do it with humility as well. They must say, look, we can be wrong, but to the best of our knowledge, based on all the evidence that we have, this is what we think.
I suppose this really gets right to the very point of how difficult it is to make any judicial system work, isn't it? Because you really want as clear-cut a process as possible. We're dealing with facts and evidence, an almost scientific approach. But there's always going to be messiness, isn't there?
Of course there is, and you always have messy forensic experts giving evidence. You know, forensic scientists, whether they be forensic psychologists or physical scientists, are the new gods in some way. But, you know, they do get things wrong. And one of the major reasons for miscarriages is that forensic scientists often are wrong in terms of the assumptions they make, whether it be about DNA, which is a powerful technique, but things can go wrong with that, or whether it be about blood splatter, or whether it be about anything else. Forensic scientists can get things wrong.
My guest in conversation today is criminologist and forensic psychologist Professor Paul Wilson. He's chair of criminology at Bond University, and he's returned to conversations to talk about wrongful convictions and miscarriages of justice. Now, that kind of sounds like the same thing at first glance, but they're two different things, aren't they, Paul? Wrongful convictions and miscarriages of justice.
Miscarriages of justice essentially refers to a situation where justice has not been served, where something's gone wrong legally, where a person hasn't received proper legal advice, for example, or where the judge has made an erroneous assumption in terms of a summing up. There's no assumption necessarily that the person is actually innocent of the crime. Wrongful convictions, on the other hand, means that a person is actually is innocent of a crime for which he or she has been convicted of. Proving a wrongful conviction is very, very difficult indeed. So in most cases, we talk about miscarriages of justice. In a lot of cases, for example, like the Stafford case, the one I am currently working on and have been for a number of years with a number of other people, the court decided this was a miscarriage of justice. They haven't said that Stafford is innocent of the crime. And that's very hard. To actually prove innocence is very difficult.
Because the burden's flipped around, isn't it?
Flipped around. Yeah. And until you actually find the perpetrator, take the Stafford case, that stigma of perhaps Graham Stafford is, you know, guilty always remains.
All right, let's talk about that case in more detail. Tell me the facts of that truly dreadful dreadful crime that was committed that he was wrongfully convicted of.
Well, Graham Stafford was accused of, in 1991, of killing his girlfriend's 12-year-old sister in a very brutal and murderous way. It was assumed that he was sexually assaulted her and then hit her around the head with a hammer, basically. And Graham Crowley, who investigated this case initially for the Staffords and has spent 10 years looking at it, and I got together and re-examined all the evidence. Graham had actually done that very thoroughly over a number of years, and every bit of forensic evidence seemed to suggest that in the initial trial, the forensic scientists had got it wrong.
What was wrong with the Crown's case against Graham Stafford?
What was wrong was it was essentially based on circumstantial evidence. There was no real motive established. It was based on the fact that there was meant to be tire evidence at where the body was dumped, and the tire evidence was shown not to be necessarily that of tires congruent with Stafford's car. There was blood evidence in terms of blood on clothing. There was maggot evidence, which we can go through in some detail. It was assumed that there was a maggot in the car, Stafford's car, that conformed with maggots found on Leanne Holland's body, but there are questions about how that maggot actually got into the car and why it wasn't photographed. There was assumptions in the trial that the killing took place in the bathroom of the Holland home, but when in fact that was re-examined, now no one, not even the Supreme Court, believes that the killing actually took place in the home. So every bit of forensic evidence, and one can spend a lot of time going through all of it, initially seemed to confirm that Stafford was guilty, but when it was re-examined in some detail, it just didn't hold up.
But where was the defence counsel in this case? Why wasn't the defence able to poke holes in the forensic evidence?
Well, in the committal stage, the defence was actually very good, and the particular lawyer was going to take the Supreme Court case, but he wasn't able to at the last moment because he had another case which suddenly came up which he had a duty to actually take. So the case was handed over to another lawyer who virtually only had a weekend to go through literally hundreds of pages of complex forensic evidence. And as a result of that, it was very difficult for him to actually ask the very hard questions to the forensic scientists that needed to be asked. So errors which were perpetrated in the committal stage, I think, went right through to the Supreme Court case. And indeed, went through to two appeal courts appeals to the Supreme Court, which occurred in that case as well.
So errors compounded on other errors and created a kind of snowball effect?
And that happens in miscarriages of justice. Errors that you get in the investigative stage, and there are many errors, I would suggest, in the actual investigation of Stafford and in the interviewing of Stafford, get carried through in the adjudicative or in the court phase. I mean, one of the things with Stafford was that he was interviewed by the police, and the interview looks as though Stafford was very unclear about the dates where he was at particular times. It looks like he was trying to cover up a lie. But when you actually analyse the interview, the police were confused about the questions they were asking. The questions were so confusing, you or I would have found it very difficult to actually answer in a coherent way. And just looking at the interview, the record of interview, shows you this very, very clearly indeed.
Because he'd been convicted of the murder of a young teenage girl, what was his life in prison like once he was sent to prison?
Well, his life in prison was hell. I don't want to go through all the details, but he does tell the story, and he's told it to me, and he's told it to my students of how he was badly bashed up as being a paedophile, child killer, etc. There's always somebody there in prison who wants to make himself bigger by bashing up somebody who's called a sex offender, and that's what happened to him. So he's a very quiet man, with a very quiet and, I think, a very nice personality. In fact, I've talked to a prison officer who said to me, look, of all the people who've been in this prison, Graham Stafford's the only person I believe was actually innocent. And he told me that before Stafford was actually released.
How long did he serve in prison?
About 14 years. 14 years.
And how was it that the conviction was eventually overturned, quashed? I'm not quite sure what word you use in his case.
Quashed in his case. I think it came as a result, and this is often happens in miscarriages, of the initial work done by Graham Crowley, who reinvestigated all the assumptions made by the forensic scientists and by the police.
This is a policeman, Graham Crowley. Yeah.
He was a police officer. And then he retired and became a private detective, and he was hired initially by the Staffords after Graham Stafford was convicted to look into the case again. What he did, the Staffords ran out of money after a few weeks and couldn't pay him anymore, but Graham Crowley decided that he would go ahead and reinvestigate the case. Then Graham and I wrote a book about the case, and then various news media took it up, and I think the fact that they took it up gave it some public airing. It had already gone through the appeal court twice, through the High Court three times without any changes, and as a result of being able to get a petition to the governor, the appeal court heard it again, and the conviction was squashed. Now it's being re-examined by a police cold case review, and we'll find out in due course what they come up with.
Our guest today in conversation is the criminologist and forensic psychologist Professor Paul Wilson. And Paul spent many years highlighting miscarriages of justice and wrongful convictions, which happen disturbingly often in Australia and overseas as well. What kind of incidents are we talking about here when we're talking about these kinds of wrongful convictions and miscarriages of justice, Paul?
Incidents? You mean what sorts of things happen?
Well, I mean how often? I mean how?
Okay.
I mean, well, are you able to give percentages, and are they reliable of how often wrongful convictions happen in the court system?
Well, one of the most conservative estimates around the world is 1% of all criminal cases. Okay, that's the most conservative, the lowest possible estimate, which I think people in Britain, in the USA and in Australia say. That's the lowest possible. Michael Kirby, the former High Court judge, of course, talks about between 2 and 3% at least. One study done fairly recently, one of the most thorough studies of exonerations and homicide cases in the USA, showed that the figure is something like 2.3%. That is of major cases. But if you just take the very conservative 1% figure, that leads to something like 360, 370 cases in Australia every year. That's in the Supreme or District Court. That is major cases. If you include Magistrates Court as well as Supreme Courts and District Courts, you're talking thousands of cases each year. That is people who, for whatever reason, are convicted of crimes for which they did not commit. This might be due to plea bargaining. They agree to, in the case of magistrates' court, they agree to say they are guilty so that they won't get such a major fine or term of imprisonment. Or it could be that the magistrate finds them guilty anyway because there's really no legal testing of the particular case against them.
What kind of mechanisms do we have for redress when in cases of wrongful conviction?
It's very hard. It really we do have an appeal court, and the appeal court is very good. I think over the last 10 years there have been something like 180 cases in Queensland, for example, which have been overturned by appeal courts. But there are very real difficulties on appeal courts. They can't consider new evidence. You've only got a certain amount of time in order to file your appeal. You've got to have money to actually, pay somebody to legally do the work for you. If you're inside, you're not rich, you don't have contacts, it's damn hard.
But there are reasons for that, aren't they? Because, every conviction could get bogged down through the appeal process and we'd have a judicial system that would grind to a halt.
Well, that's absolutely right. But, some people would say you should give people more time to appeal so it's fairer. You should allow fresh evidence or new evidence that has been found. It should be a far cheaper and easier process. And there are other countries like Great Britain which have made it just like that.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Professor Paul Wilson is my guest. He's a criminologist, forensic psychologist, chair of criminology at Bond University, and he spent much of his career talking about cases where people have been wrongfully convicted or suffered a miscarriage of justice. And these are really quite hair-raising stories. DNA evidence is said to be the new panacea for these things. DNA, and of course, DNA evidence has overturned so many cases of wrongful conviction. I understand there's like a governor in the United States, in the state of Michigan, who when he saw how many people on death row, their convictions were being overturned due to DNA evidence, gave up on his opposition to the death penalty as a result of that. So DNA evidence has really turned this around, hasn't it, Paul?
Well, it's seen as the new panacea. It was Illinois, actually, Governor Ryan, who decided to exonerate people on death row when he saw the number of mistakes which have been made in terms of major homicide cases which were overturned by DNA evidence. And let me say, DNA is a powerful forensic tool. It's good at making sure the guilty are convicted and at times freeing the innocents. And that there have been at least 17 people on death row in the United States who have been freed as a result of DNA showing they couldn't possibly have been involved. There are about 240 in the USA who've been exonerated by DNA evidence. So it's powerful.
Does it create problems, though?
It does. Really does. I mean, one of the problems is that DNA is often given in terms of one in every 5 billion, so people think, well, that must mean that the person is guilty, and there is real arguments about whether those figures are right or not based on the samples which are taken, and so there's disagreements statistically amongst DNA experts about what the figure should
be. Well, even if it's a 1 in 20,000 likelihood it matches up, that's still pretty compelling, isn't it?
It's still pretty compelling, but let's take the Fitzherbert case. That is the case of the guy who was accused of killing the president of the Cat Society, one of my favourite cases because it's one of the early convictions, one of the few convictions based on DNA entirely, and he was convicted on DNA evidence.
This is the Andrew Fitzherbert case.
The Andrew Fitzherbert case, the Cat Society, where there were so many possible suspects because, the people in the Cat Society actually didn't seem to like cats. They really were fighting for positions of power. But he was convicted. He was convicted of the case based on DNA evidence. And my point here is that one scientist for the prosecution said that there was one in 100 million chance. Another scientist later on has come along and said, look, the chance was only one in 100,000. Now, if you take the population of Australia being 25 million, that still gives you, about perhaps 250 people who could who could have similar DNA.
Still extremely
unlikely, but there is a big difference between, say, you know, there are 250 people out there who could commit the crime, as distinct from saying there are 3 billion or whatever the huge number is. But besides that, the problem with DNA evidence is that just because there is DNA at a scene of a crime does not necessarily mean that it was placed there before the murder. It could have been placed before the murder took place, during the murder, or after the murder. In the Andrew Fitzherbert case, you see, the one of the issues is that the DNA which matched Fitzherbert's was said by one forensic scientist to have degraded earlier than other bloodstains found at the scene of the crime, which meant that Fitzherbert could well have been there before the murder took place. So DNA by itself is not conclusive evidence.
Right. It may prove that you were present, but it doesn't necessarily make
you the
perpetrator.
Doesn't say when. And then you've got the problems of actually, you know, was the DNA mixed up in the laboratory? How was it transferred from the scene of the crime to where it was analysed? Was there any contagion between DNA samples in the laboratory? You've got all those issues. So DNA by itself is not conclusive evidence of a crime being committed.
Let's talk about the case of the sad case of Andrew Mallard in Western Australia.
Yeah.
Tell me, he was picked up for the murder of a Perth woman. Why was he found to be the likely suspect in the minds of police?
Well, I think several reasons. Andrew Mallard was, as you say, picked up for the murder of a woman, a very brutal murder again. He was subjected to a police interview. The police interview went for something like 20 hours altogether, and only 20 minutes of that was actually recorded on tape. Andrew Mallard suffered from a form of psychosis where he wanted to help people. He wanted to show how good and clever he was. And during the interview, and I've seen extracts of the interview, it was shown actually on ABC Four Corners at one stage, it was clear that Mallard was trying to help the police, trying to tell them how he thought the murder was being committed.
I've got a bit of the transcript here, and the officer says, "You said that you needed money." Andrew Mallard said, "I did," with a kind of rising inflection at the end there. "I did." "And you told us that you went in through the rear of the shop at the Flora Metallica. Is that what you told us?" "I told you that." Okay, I'm just going to go through that now, okay? What you told us, we'll sort the rest out later, okay? "You told us you went on the front of such and such street. You were looking back and you saw that the door was shut." "Yes." So it's a case where in court it wouldn't be admissible because it's a case where you'd say the prosecutor was leading, or the lawyer was leading the witness.
Yeah, sure.
Presenting the suspect with these statements and seeing if the accused person agrees with that.
Yes.
What's happening here when you see at this transcript, the interview with Andrew Mallard?
Well, what you're seeing is somebody who's actually trying to help the police, who believes he's being asked, how did this murder occur? And he's saying, I think it occurred like this. And they are saying, well, you're the actual murderer. And he's not really saying that at all. He's just trying to help them. But when you look at the transcript, it looks as though, very much as though, you know, he is perhaps guilty of the crime. But anyone who knows anything about personalities of this sort know that they are quite capable of overreaching what they actually do know and making it appear as though they might well possibly be the person who committed the crime.
Now he had no history of violence. No murder weapon had been found. No blood was found on him, despite the violence of the murder, and there was blood everywhere at the crime scene. And he had a history of mental illness?
Yes, he had, yes. So, and he was a homeless guy at this age, yep.
So was there any evidence at all outside the confession that had been recorded?
None really whatsoever. You know, there was no motive. It was very hard to, there was no forensic evidence. It was very hard to see why, in fact, he would have committed the crime, except for the interview, which really was the thing that actually sunk him.
He served a decade in prison or thereabouts.
Yes, he did, yeah.
How eventually was he released? How was his case overturned or quashed again?
I think it was a combination of lawyers who took up the case pro bono and also journalist Colin Egan, who wrote a book about the case and Reddy followed it up. And it was the journalists and the lawyers who worked together to get public exposure about the case, which was eventually settled in the High Court, when the High Court said, look, you know, this Ballard couldn't have possibly committed this crime, and the DPP decided not to take up the case again. The trial was squashed. The DPP had the chance of accusing him of the crime again and retrying it, but they didn't.
Does that mean he was exonerated?
Yes, he has virtually been now, because there is evidence that another man who in prison committed the crime, who subsequently committed suicide. He has been compensated now for the
wrongful imprisonment. Yes.
Yeah, and has received some millions of dollars, which is more than most victims of miscarriage actually get.
In the UK, the researchers have discovered that after eyewitness identification, false confessions are the second most common cause of miscarriages of justice, and the same results are obtained in the United States. In this case, he had a mental illness of some kind and had been homeless and was saying things that were being put, agreeing with things that were being put to him. What are some of the reasons why people do sometimes confess to crimes they have not committed?
Well, lots of reasons. First of all, if you are interviewed for 10 hours, often you'll confess to something just to get away from the interviewers. Even if they aren't physically bashing you up, the psychological stress of being interviewed is very severe. Interviewing me for 20 hours would make me say anything you want to, Richard.
Really?
For example.
Let's stay here for another 19 after this then today.
Absolutely. And that's one reason that, you know, just people want to get away from being questioned all the time about various things. Another reason is that they do have severe psychological problems. Another reason is that some people want their 7 minutes of fame. They want to, you know, they want to say, I'm guilty of the serial murder. I mean, I know rape situations where the police will tell you, they get two or three people come along and said, you know, I committed this rape, and they weren't even in the same city or the same, you know, couldn't have possibly done it. So
is that to show off or draw attention to themselves, or is it because they feel they're guilty of a whole lot of different things and they want someone to prosecute them?
It's a whole combination.
Do people
of those
do that? Do
reasons?
They, do they go, oh, well, I've done this and wrong in my life, so I might confess to this thing I've not done, so I can be atone in a way?
Yeah, sure. Sometimes they do it for that reason. Sometimes they do it because you know, the police almost make them believe that they have committed the crime. And that nearly happened in a very famous case that really got me working on miscarriages in 1989 in New York, the Central Joggers case, where a young Wall Street woman who worked at Wall Street was jogging in Central Park and was terribly raped and bashed. It made headlines all over New York and indeed all over the world at that stage.
Yeah, now the nature of that crime was so heinous. It was truly dreadful. She was beaten almost to the point of death and raped brutally and found some hours after it happened. And the way that case was presented in the internationally, in fact, it was like, what's coming? What are we coming to as a people? What's wrong with the world?
Yes.
Our society is deeply sick. Because five guys were picked up for that crime.
Yes.
Tell me about those guys.
Well, one Latino and four African Americans were picked up, young teenagers who had actually been in the park at the time, might well have been carrying out other crimes, such as, you know, stealing things from joggers and others who were in the park. That could have been possible. But they were picked up and they were interviewed separately. And the interviews revealed that they said, yes, we committed the crime. And I saw it on television. I saw some of the interviews and I was absolutely sure that they had committed the crime too. So was everyone else.
I remember this because during the testimony that they gave, their confessions, they said that they were listening to that Tone Loc song, Wild Thing, and they called this process Wilding.
Wilding, that's right,
and,
yeah.
And that was a meme that went out in the whole wide world.
Yeah, sure.
It's the new hip thing for young people to be doing, to
that's
brutally
right.
attack people and call it Wilding because
sure.
it's a...
Sure.
And that got out as well. It went to trial. What happened at the trial?
Well, they were convicted at trial, and people believed the confessions and believed that they actually had committed the crime.
Because you'd seen the confessions, as you
I'd
said.
Seen the confessions,
and
I thought, yeah, sure. I thought that was quite legitimate. I couldn't see any evidence that the police had done anything wrong. I couldn't see any reason why they would confess to the crime. But
so
then,
New York had a big sigh of relief, and they went, well, we've found this,
we found this,
these demons, essentially, and we've now put the demons away, and that's that. We've put them aside, and justice has been done. How did it come unstuck?
It came up stuck when people started, lawyers and others started reinvestigating the case because the kids, while they were in jail, kept saying, well, look, we didn't actually mean to confess. We didn't commit this crime. And when you started to reanalyze the actual interviews, it was found, well, they weren't quite as neat and tidy as initially the police presented them. What seemed to have happened was that the police made each of the individuals believe that others had confessed to the crime, others in the group had confessed to the crime, and that they must have been, they themselves, that is the individual they were talking to now, must have been involved as well.
So we see that in movies all the time, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the other two suspects,
actually,
different rooms. The cops come in and they go, oh, your buddy's giving you away. They said this. Do you want to sign up to it? This really does happen then, does it?
It really does happen. In the actual Joggers case, the real person came along and admitted to committing the crime. So the analysis of the interview came about after the real person who committed the crime admitted to having done it. But it really does happen that people actually do confess to things which they haven't done.
The thing that's interesting about the trial of these guys is there was almost no evidence, again, put to the court apart from their confessions. Their confessions were pretty much the sole basis that they recanted on. They were in the trial, they recanted, didn't they? Or did they keep their they maintain those?
It was mixed. Some of them recanted, some of them didn't. So it was mixed.
In the jury room, our jurors afterwards said that they knocked it backwards and forwards. They really did give it a good go, didn't they? But they said we applied a common sense approach, which was that to look at these confessions, these guys confessed. They did it in tape. They're there in the presence of their relatives. They're not under threat or coercion. They confess.
Well, it's pretty powerful. If you say that you committed a crime, well, people are going to think that you probably did. Most people don't think that you confessed to murder or rape or arson or whatever it happens to be if you didn't do it. But you do. Or some people do.
Well, it's hard to blame juries for applying a common sense test, but it's fascinating that common sense doesn't get you very far in these cases sometimes.
Well, common sense doesn't get you far in terms of eyewitness reports. We know that. Common sense doesn't get you very far in terms of confessions sometimes. Common sense doesn't get you far in terms of memory, for example. Often our memories are badly distorted by events that happen, and we remember things which never happened, So common sense only takes you so far, and that's why I would argue we need experts to tell us something about the weaknesses in common sense.
That's interesting, the weakness in common sense. Yep. So we put such value on common sense. But I don't know, just looking at the background of these cases before you came in today, it struck me as the human beings are kind of weird, aren't they?
Yes.
And, well, and common sense, people, it's not really clear why any of us do things sometimes. It's not clear at all.
Well, I mean, I think talking about cases, if you take, for example, the case of Kelvin Condren, a Queensland Aboriginal man who was convicted in 1983 of murdering his wife, essentially, and spent 7 years in jail, and then it was found that he hadn't actually committed the crime at all, even though there was allegedly a confession. He said, yes, I committed this crime. It was found out later that he didn't commit the crime because he was in a police lockup at the time the crime was actually committed.
Yet he confessed to it. That's a pretty ironclad alibi, isn't it?
One of the best alibis you can have. If you want to commit a crime, try and get on a police lockup. It's hard to do it if you're going to commit a crime, but nevertheless.
The murder took place under circumstances within a community as such that where there's so much substance abuse going on. Is that the problem there?
Well, it's not only substance abuse, it's also alcohol, I think. And in the case of Kelvin Condren, the record of interview, and I'll be careful how I word this, but it did seem to show that Kelvin Condren was agreeing with every question put to him by the police officers. And this often happens with Indigenous defendants. It's a process called gratuitous concurrence, which means that you agree with somebody who you think's superior to you. Indigenous people often think that somebody in authority who's white deserves to be given yes answers to. So you get this yes, 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 I did this when questioned, but of course that's not what actually happened.
What does this has a terribly corrosive effect on the confidence that we have in our justice system when these cases are brought to light. Again, I want to ask that question about redress of this. Britain has something in place, doesn't it? A mechanism in place for a redress of wrongful convictions and miscarriages of justice.
Britain has what's called the Criminal Cases Review Commission, where anyone can actually apply to have their case reheard by the court of appeal if the Criminal Cases Review Commission suggests that that should be done.
Now, is this something that came out of the conviction of the Guildford Four?
It came out of the conviction of the Guildford Four, essentially, who were allegedly Irish terrorists who weren't involved in the bombing
of the pub
in Guildford. Yeah. And the trial, or the reanalysis of the trial when they were found innocent, showed very clearly that the police had planted evidence, made up stories, the prosecution had withheld evidence.
In fact, they found a document, didn't they, that said, with evidence which at the top said, not to be shown to the defence.
Absolutely. So the Criminal Cases Review Commission came out of that, and it looks at, it's very easy to actually fill in if you think you've been the victim of a miscarriage, to fill in the form and send it in. However, only 4% of all applications actually lead to the appeal court overturning the case again. So, you know, not many get through. It's a fairly thorough process. But this is an independent body. They do their own investigations. And it removes, I think, any feeling as though you can't overturn a miscarriage, because you can.
Given that you have been involved in the Graham Stafford case yourself, just tell me what that's like dealing with authorities when you're trying to get a wrongful conviction overturned. Why there is resistance? I mean, I can understand why, but what's your experience of that and your understanding of what's going on in the mind of institutional resistance to?
Well, I think if you take the police, for example, they don't want to have it looked at again because it shows they were wrong. It can, and I'm not talking about the Stafford case, but it can in many cases show that some of their officers might have been corrupt in some miscarriage cases.
Saying that's not the case necessarily?
I'm saying that's not necessarily the case in the Stafford case. I'm saying in other cases in Australia and indeed around the world, police have been corrupt. They've withheld evidence. Or if it doesn't show corruption, it can show that they are full of what's called tunnel vision, which means that they're absolutely focused on one person who they think is guilty and ignore other leads. So that's one reason why the police don't want cases.
And often they're dealing with a media and public outrage pushing them along.
Sure,
too, aren't they?
Sure. And that's the other thing. It's perfectly true to say that the relatives of victims of major crimes often don't want the crime looked at again, raked over again, because, you know, they've had some sort of closure, and that's why governments often don't want to revisit a particular case, because they think it's going to upset the victim's relatives in the case of murder. But departments of prosecutions don't want to look at cases again because they don't want to show they've been wrong in the first place. Governments don't want the embarrassment of their justice system looking as though things have gone badly wrong. And every case of miscarriage of justice weakens the credibility that the justice system has. But as well as that, I think, what a miscarriage does is, you know, not only harming the victim of the miscarriage, but it harms the victim and the relatives of the victim of the original crime, because they haven't got closure. They have to reopen it again.
And there's another thing too. The real perpetrator may still be at large.
Absolutely.
You commit more crime.
Sure, absolutely. And that's why miscarriages are really important to look at, because the real person who committed the rape, the arson, the murder is still out there somewhere.
Somewhere indeed. You mentioned about the role that forensic psychologists might have in court cases where they might be able to offer advice to a court on the reliability of witness testimony. Are there any other ways in which forensic psychologists can actually step in to prevent these these things can happen? Because that's the ideal situation, of course.
I think it is, yeah.
Prevention is better than cure, isn't it?
I think it is, and I do think in the areas of false commission, eyewitness testimony, for example, memory and the problems of memory, we have a lot to offer in terms of giving advice to police officers, going through cases with defence lawyers and pointing out weaknesses in eyewitness testimony or in memory or in a confession or in the interrogation. You know, I don't think we're magicians. We can't do things which will automatically overturn a miscarriage case. But I think we've got a lot to offer defence, and I would think prosecutors too, so that miscarriages don't go ahead. I think they should also be able to give evidence in court in far more circumstances than they're able to now, and I hope I can convince some of my legal and judicial colleagues to agree with me.
Can you tell when people are lying?
I can't by looking at you right now. I think because I've done training courses on lying, once I establish a baseline, I could probably do reasonably well. By that I mean that I could probably tell you if you're lying 60 to 80% of the time. However, in saying that, I would also admit that psychologists and police officers and judges are no better than anyone else at detecting liars. We think we're good at detecting liars, but we're not actually very good. Most of us think that we can tell by looking at how you move your eyes, but in fact, we're not very good at doing that with any degree of reliability at all.
Tugging at the earlobe, scratching at the nose.
All these things are not signs of that a person is lying. But I do think there are, with training, reasonably reliable techniques which can tell you, with training, the likelihood of a person lying. When I say likelihood, I'm talking about probability. I'm not talking about certainty. We get things wrong as forensic psychologists. We've got to admit that we get things wrong. We've got to be humble. But I think with training and using evidence-based techniques, we can do better than chance most of the time.
Paul, it's been a great pleasure having you on, and I'm being perfectly sincere when I say that. You see, I'm not tugging my earlobe. I'm not scratching my nose. I've enjoyed having you on enormously today.
Okay.
I mean that.
Thanks, Richard. I believe you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.